Hey there, everyone. You're listening to The Forum, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP for short. If you're new to our show, allow me to be the first to say welcome and thanks for choosing to socialize with science today. And if you're a returning listener, welcome back. We're glad to have you. My name is Aubrey, and Cleo and Daniela will once again be joining me today for our bi-weekly science and society discussion.
Hey all, it's Cleo, and I just want to remind you, whether you're new to the forum or a seasoned listener, that you should give us a follow on Twitter for episode updates, live chats with your co-host, and current events articles. You'll find us at the handle at ISGPForum.
We welcome your frequent questions and comments about our episodes on Twitter, where you should totally tag your posts with hashtag ISGPForum, and also on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum. Oh, and this is Daniela, by the way.
Let's get started then, shall we? Today's episode topic is pretty different than those we've discussed before for several reasons, one of which is the fact that it ties together both health and food issues. Today, we'll talk about type 2 diabetes, using the disease's incidence in Asian populations as a case study.
The policy position paper up for discussion today is titled Asian Diabetes: Cause, Challenges, and Healthcare Reform. And it was debated at the September 2015 ISGP conference held at North Dakota State University. The conference was themed Food Security and Diet-Linked Public Health Challenges.
I'm seeing the food and health connections already. Anyway, this paper was authored and defended by Dr. Devanjan Sichter, an associate professor of pediatric endocrinology at the University of Florida College of Medicine.
So, I guess if you're a returning listener, you'll know that we often like to set the stage at the start of an episode with some statistics that are supposed to make your jaw drop and make you say, whoa, and help convince you that the topic of interest is some sort of problem that needs fixing. Today is no exception.
Certainly no exception. For instance, I could tell you that the grand total of direct medical costs in the U.S. stemming from newly diagnosed diabetes is around $245 billion per year. That number comes from the year 2012 and represents a 41% increase over the previous five-year period.
And when you think globally, that figure rises to over $500 billion U.S. dollars spent in diabetes-related healthcare costs. Probably because there are more than 240 million diabetic individuals in the world.
So what you're saying is that diabetes is increasing in prevalence and that it's expensive to deal with.
That's about accurate. 17 million people in the United States are specifically afflicted with type 2 diabetes, or T2D. As you probably know, diabetic individuals are diagnosed with either the type 1 or the type 2 variety.
Maybe we should briefly go over what diabetes actually is. I mean, its causes and manifestations, not to mention how people live with it.
Great idea. So, the story of diabetes revolves around a hormone called insulin, which is produced in the pancreas and helps to keep your blood sugar level from getting too high or low.
Essentially, your body's cells need sugar so that they have the energy to do all the fun things that cells do, but sugar can't enter the cells on its own. When your blood sugar increases, say, after you've eaten that giant bag of Sour Patch Kids that's been sitting on your desk since Monday, staring at you all week, tempting your self-control.
I can't help but feel we've unleashed some deep psychological issues here.
Hey, stop it. Anyway, when your blood sugar increases after a meal, beta cells in your pancreas release insulin into the bloodstream. It's in the bloodstream that the insulin acts as a mediator, permitting entry of sugar molecules into those cells. Insulin also helps store excess sugar in the liver until it's needed, like when you've been working in the lab all day and haven't eaten since that bagel during breakfast.
More deep-seated issues?
So how is diabetes related to all of this cell biology mumbo-jumbo? Well, individuals with type 1 diabetes actually don't make insulin in the first place, so they typically rely on insulin injections to allow their cells to take up sugar and prevent blood sugar levels from rising too high.
And for type 2 diabetes, aka the variant we'll focus on today, afflicted individuals either don't respond well to insulin or are resistant to it. So they have insulin in their bodies, but it doesn't really result in effective sugar entry into cells.
As a result, patients with T2D can be treated with oral medications and tend to benefit greatly from lifestyle changes, so things like diet and exercise. However, T2D is a progressive disease, so usually over time, patients end up requiring insulin injections.
Lastly, it's worth noting that certain groups of people are more prone to developing T2D than others. According to the American Diabetes Association, some of the most commonly afflicted groups include African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, and Asian Americans.
And for today's topic, it's super important to clarify that people with a predisposition or susceptibility to type 2 diabetes are much more likely to actually develop the disease if they have an unhealthy diet and lack of physical exercise. So bad food and activity habits, which tend to equal obesity and other health problems, also equal higher likelihood of T2D development.
In his paper, Dr. Sigter reminded us that if current incidence trends continue, 1 in 3 American adults will have diabetes by the year 2050. So one of the three of us, statistically, would be diabetic. That's nuts.
One of the reasons that diabetic incidence in the US is increasing so rapidly is because high-risk populations, like Asian Americans, are acquiring the disease at an alarming rate. And when it comes to immigrant populations, Asian Indians comprise the second fastest group of people immigrating into the US.
When they reach the United States, immigrants often replace traditional food sources, so the foods they'd typically eat back in their home country, with good old American fast food. And I mean, why wouldn't you? When you have a choice of McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, Chick-fil-A, In-N-Out, Whataburger, Arby's, Hardee's, Smashburger.
Okay, Cleo, we get it. Lots of processed food options. And we can frown upon them as much as we want, but that doesn't change the fact that processed food and takeout is cheap and convenient, making it super appealing for a lot of people, whether they were born here or not.
It's also worth mentioning that some traditional or religious beliefs aren't always the healthiest, and this can also contribute to diabetes development and progression.
That's actually really true, and I think it's often forgotten. For instance, pregnant women in Indian populations are often fed high-fat and high-carbohydrate diets. These diets include ghee, a clarified butter of sorts that is way high in saturated fatty acid content.
Outside of the pregnancy situation, ghee is actually burned in temples, so it's thought not to cause harm and, actually quite the opposite, bring positive energy. From a scientific and dietary standpoint, though, the impacts are a lot less clear.
I mean, I consider myself the foodie out of the trio here, and I feel obligated to mention the current perspective of my people regarding ghee, which happens to be quite positive. For instance, some studies now report that ghee can help lower cholesterol or keep certain heart conditions in check, and it's a nutritional essential for health nuts that buy into the healing traditions.
Yeah, but this is the same stuff that's basically all fat. Not to mention the fact that food crazes change about as quickly as some celebrities' hair colors. So, okay, to be fair, maybe the jury's still out on this one, but the overarching point of this example remains. Homeopathy and Western medicines do not always see eye to eye.
Yeah, which is not the greatest scenario. In any case, when Asian Indians are engaging in some of these traditional customs or are switching from traditional to processed food sources, they're often thrust into a pre-diabetic state. It also doesn't help that these groups seem to have a genetic predisposition for diabetes.
Asian Indians who experience prediabetes typically transition into full-on T2D pretty rapidly because they tend not to adopt the lifestyle changes that could keep the condition in check. This all makes sense to me, but do we have any idea where the genetic predisposition for T2D comes from?
We do, yeah. According to Dr. Sichter, this predisposition is essentially determined prenatally because when Asian Indians are born, they tend to have a higher body fat percentage and higher insulin levels than Caucasian newborns, despite having a lower overall body weight. Age of diabetes onset is also younger for Asian Indians. Hey, get this. Did you know that a common age of onset for T2D in this population is between 22 and 39?
Considering that we fall within that age bracket, that sounds a little scary.
Anyway, sorry, I got distracted thinking about how I should really lay off those Sour Patch Kids. But the Asian diabetes trend kind of gets worse because later on in life, this population's T2D is characterized by greater abdominal obesity, greater insulin resistance, higher insulin concentrations in the body even when not eating, and early loss of beta cell function.
Those beta cells were the ones that produced the insulin in the first place, right?
Yep, those are the ones.
And these trends in Asian Indian diabetes are pretty standard regardless of age, gender, or body mass index.
All the same, we know very little about the mechanistic mode of action of type 2 diabetes in Asian Americans, much like other minority groups. This is because the majority of studies that lend us preventative and therapeutic insight come from Caucasian focus groups.
And if you think the results of the studies should be transferable, think again.
Think again is right. Differences in body size and physiology between people of different descent can result in wildly different manifestations of diseases.
An example might be appropriate here, so I've got one all ready to go for us. It turns out that a certain gene polymorphism, aka a genetic variation, called Pro12ALA, affords protection against diabetes and insulin resistance to Caucasians, but has no protective effect for Asians.
And to fully grasp this subtlety, Pro12ALA essentially means that in the 12th amino acid of a particular protein, a protein that happens to function as a receptor molecule in cells, an amino acid called proline is replaced by a different amino acid called alanine. This one itty-bitty switch means that I might be less prone to T2D than an Asian American counterpart. But that's molecular biology for you. Crazy.
Around 70 genes in the human genome have been associated with type 2 diabetes heritability. Just how applicable all of these genes are to predicting type 2 diabetes in Asian Americans is still pretty questionable, though. In fact, a 2011 study actually ended up introducing more questions about type 2 diabetes predisposition in Asians, so it's kind of hard not to say we need more research regarding this challenging topic.
It was very clear to the debaters that study participants of Asian descent must be recruited to establish a better understanding of genetic and environmental causation, not to mention prevention of type 2 diabetes.
Right. It's crucial for us to better understand the genetics at play here so that predisposition can be quickly and easily predicted, allowing doctors to help non-diabetic patients take action to prevent, or at least delay, the onset of T2D.
This is doubly important because there's currently no good preventive screening tool for type 2 diabetes in Asian Indians. I mean, for lots of other populations, a physician might be concerned if the patient is obese.
But in Asian Indians, an early age of onset matched with typically little to no early weight gain makes for a diagnostic challenge. This is probably one of the reasons the debaters agree that screening for diabetes should begin at around 20 to 23 years of age in Asian populations so that early cases can be quickly spotted.
Right. And I think that's why Dr. Sigter calls for widespread genetic testing ability to be established and then utilized. That way, even if the disease doesn't manifest at an early age, high risk of future affliction can be determined.
And a genetic test could help to optimize personal treatments for T2D, since not all patients respond well to generic treatments and medicines like sulfonylurea.
Once these predispositions and genetic factors are better teased out, Dr. Sigter also suggested that patient empowerment campaigns could be useful to help keep T2D in check for afflicted individuals, as well as people who are expected to develop the disease.
We should note that group education and counseling to high-risk and youth populations is already occurring as a means of fighting T2D incidents.
And I think those are the types of programs and empowerment campaigns that Dr. Sigter had in mind.
However, it still tends to be difficult to get both pre-diabetic and diabetic individuals to adhere to diet and exercise regimens that would really help protect their health.
That's why Dr. Sigter says that small businesses outside of the healthcare sector could be super valuable for counseling individuals about their diet and exercise. I guess this type of business would look like something in between a dietitian's office and your local Planet Fitness.
The name of the game with this sort of strategy would really be positive lifestyle reinforcement, something that's apparently critically lacking for T2D afflicted or at-risk people. And taking things one step further, these sorts of businesses could also offer periodic tests for blood sugar and pressure levels, lipid concentrations, and body composition.
This latter point that Aubrey mentioned is pretty critical, actually. The debaters noted that one-third of all diabetics might actually be undiagnosed because they've never been tested for HbA1c or hemoglobin A1c, a molecule in the body that's bound to glucose and reflects blood sugar levels over the past 6 to 8 weeks as opposed to a single day.
And routine glucose monitoring is unavailable to a lot of T2D patients, which is really a shame because it's an easy way to prevent T2D from progressing. So, there you have it. There's room in the business sphere for lifestyle reinforcement and monitoring of T2D patients. Entrepreneurs, do your thing.
This sort of positive reinforcement is all well and good and definitely makes the patient more accountable for health outcomes, but there's always going to be a point at which actual health care is needed to address T2D issues.
True, and it's no secret that there are currently pretty obvious healthcare disparities and differences in nutritional food access between lower and higher income populations.
Well, the former issue, dealing with healthcare disparities, might be improved by encouraging employers to provide an insurance that's patient-centered and focused on managed care. Also, though, we shouldn't shy away from incentivizing healthy and active lifestyles for all, which could be accomplished by discounting health premiums for at-risk populations and families with diabetic histories.
Then the latter issue of nutritional disparities in high and low-income areas could be addressed if local governments created regulations to enable healthier lifestyle choices, perhaps by blocking the establishment of fast food restaurants in low-income communities or taxing unhealthy food products.
Hold on for just a sec. We need to back up to Daniela's point.
Oh no, what did I say this time?
Why would any insurance company offer discounts to people that they'd expect to end up with an enormously costly disease? I mean, I'm not trying to sound like a terrible person, and I want people to have access to healthcare. I didn't mean that healthcare companies or employees shouldn't offer to help people with life-altering afflictions of T2D. I just...
Okay, we get it. You're not evil. What were you trying to say?
I just meant that I don't see a reason, you know, business-wise, why insurance companies would offer discounts to people likely to develop T2D.
Oh, and that's a super fair question. It would be somewhat of an incentive system. If people with high type 2 diabetes risk were able to adhere to dietary and physical activity plans, then insurance companies could be encouraged to offer discounts. Think of it as a preventive approach.
Yes. Rewarding citizens for gym memberships and yoga classes, which would maybe be an incentive for me to actually keep my New Year's resolution for once in my life. But wouldn't all of this just be increasing the amount of money spent on prevention instead of treatment? I mean, wouldn't we just be swapping one money sink for another?
Maybe, but remember those monetary figures we threw out there at the beginning of the show? The medical costs as well as societal costs associated with productivity losses once someone actually has T2D would far exceed these preventive expenditures.
All right, I'll buy that. But allow me to throw another wrench in the wheel, if you will.
If you must.
Well, you just referenced the national and global spending on T2D. I mentioned earlier in the show that over $200 billion is spent on diabetes care in the U.S. every year. That's a lot, right? Well, Dr. Sichter says that this high cost would sound more reasonable if it resulted in high-quality care, but, and I quote, "When compared with other developed countries, the U.S. is ranked lowest on the list for most standard measures of health." Ouch.
Shots fired.
You're not kidding. And one of several policy suggestions made by Dr. Sichter addresses this point by asking for better diabetes care coordination, so tying together the diabetes itself and any other afflictions that arise as a result. The goal of coordinated care would be to focus on care quality over care quantity.
The debaters agreed that the current U.S. healthcare model makes it really challenging to coordinate diabetes care efficiently. Blood sugar control can typically be established by a single physician at first, but as the disease progresses,
and comorbidities like obesity, high blood pressure, or kidney disease arise,
a team of doctors is usually needed to administer the various necessary treatments. Historically, this hasn't been easily facilitated.
That's why the debaters wondered if diabetes care could be modified and morphed to fit more of a business-like model, in which a team of specialists was overseen and essentially managed by one physician.
Such a model would be unique, but would mandate the efficient digital transfer of medical information between members of this hypothetical team of caregivers. It would probably cost more to operate this way, too.
The debaters seemed to like the idea, though, and even called on governments to provide funding for at least the establishment of this, quote, business model of diabetes care.
Regardless of how it's done, diabetes care is definitely an area that can be improved.
Okay, we are in agreement, but can I be a pain one more time?
It's your time to shine, Cleo.
Thank you. So let's say that an Asian Indian with T2D has access to all of the healthcare options he needs, and there's a well-coordinated medical team tending to him, and he has all the positive reinforcement he wants, and he has plenty of discounted health insurance to back him up. I venture to say that he might still not be able to adhere to healthcare regimens prescribed to him in Western civilization.
I know where you're going with this because you emphasized Western civilization.
Well, I still don't know what you're going for here. Sounds like your hypothetical person should have all the tools he needs. Where's the hang-up?
The hang-up lies in the fact that many Asian Indians typically use homeopathic remedies, believing that, for example, uranium, phosphoric acid, and heavy metals can be efficient medical treatments.
And first-generation Asian Indian immigrants are often still deeply believing in and respecting of these traditions.
It makes for difficulty achieving compliance with Western treatment regimens. I'll be careful to mention, too, that traditional or homeopathic medicine being at odds with Western medicine is a very common scenario in the United States, encompassing many ethnic groups and medical afflictions.
In any case, there's no reason why certain traditional customs can't be adapted to operate well within a Western or even just a scientific framework. It just takes a little work to connect the dots and figure out where cultural practices can be used to comply with more Western prescribed regimens.
How about another example here, shall we? It turns out that high-fiber legumes are already a prevalent part of traditional Asian diets, and epidemiological data suggests that good health and overall longevity are tied to legume consumption. So, support for and straight-up encouragement of legume consumption could be a solid diabetes prevention tool.
I see the strategy here. Discourage the adoption of the unhealthy American diet in America by encouraging people to maintain traditional food customs that are also able to ward off diabetes.
That's the idea. Not to mention the fact that there have been a handful of homeopathic treatments that, while not successful as a sole remedy, have been effective tools in combating diabetes.
In any case, the integration of safe and viable homeopathic medicines into Western treatments for T2D would be really useful to increase patient compliance. This concept of Western medical practitioners understanding cultural practices and concerns of their patients, by the way, is one example of, quote, cultural competence.
Which is a topic that could take up an entirely separate podcast episode. Consider looking it up, though. Super integral and relevant stuff.
This sounds like an appropriate place to wrap things up for the day.
Agreed. Well, to recap, today we discussed type 2 diabetes and focused on Asian Indians as a case study group with a predisposition to the disease. We discussed challenges associated with prevention and early diagnosis for this population, and we wondered about how changing the treatment system for T2D might improve patient outcomes.
I think the moral of the story today was that although government and the private sector can have pivotal roles in type 2 diabetes prevention and care, the true agent of change in this scenario is the individual.
So, with a clear healthcare challenge described here today, what do you think are the most valuable tools for preventing the T2D epidemic sweeping the nation?
Do you have experience dealing with this disease? How would some of today's discussion topics and suggested solutions impact your own experiences?
Please send us your responses and thoughts on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
Thanks in advance for sharing. We look forward to reading your comments.
And from all of us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy, thanks so much for tuning in and socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.